Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It is Friday, March 16th, 2007. Today we're going to have a public hearing on three bills, 2655, 2656, and 2658. We will not be holding a work session on any of those bills today, just public hearing. And with that, I'd like to open the public hearing on House Bill 2655. And if we could have Mark Long come forward. And is this a ABC bill? And I know we have the construction contractors board in the room too. If we have any technical questions, we'll give you a call at that point. Thank you, Mark. If you'd go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Long, the Administrator of State Building Codes Division and staff for the task force. House Bill 2655 is the result of the task force recommendation. This bill encompasses warranty requirements for contractors. I provided the committee, again, what I would call my work-in-progress staff work, if you will, to date in looking at this particular issue and working with the various stakeholders. I need to let the committee know that there are several issues yet unresolved, and this is not a consensus or a fully supported language that you have in front of you, but it's designed to provide kind of a framework of where we're at in the discussions and something to get in front of you today. Didn't want you to be absent anything. What we're trying to do with this bill is provide for a first-party warranty for contractors. And it essentially creates a 1-2-10 program, first year, if you will, bumper to bumper, year two, systems and envelope, systems being plumbing, mechanical, those kinds of things, electrical, and then years 3-10, structural. I think the issues for the committee and that we've been trying to get our arms around first start with the definition of defect, which you find in section 2 of our discussion document, again, that's in your yellow folder. And I'm not sure that that's the final language. That's just where we're at to date, and it is different than the bill as drafted. We've also heard comments on the definition of what is market value. And again, haven't been able to sort that out or work it out, but you can see what we have as the starting point to help continue the discussions with the folks that are interested in this bill. Another key piece for the committee to know is that, as proposed in this March 15th, again, staff work, is this applies to residential units, 4 units or less. So they need to be owner-occupied units, but it would not apply to all structures and then necessarily all residential structures. When you look at Section 3, that's where it kind of lays out the 1-2-10 program that I talked about, the first year bumper to bumper, and it allows the contractor to obtain the services of a third-party warranty company, basically an insurance, to cover the warranty requirements that the contractor's on the hook for. I think we've had quite a bit of discussion around Section 4 area, and one of the issues that came up is how does the warranty relate to the bond? And in Section 4 of the bill, which is, or not the bill, but the draft language, we clarify that the warranty becomes the first basis for recovery, if you will, from the consumer, and bond would come after the warranty has been resolved. And then I think the other major issue, Mr. Chair, for you to be aware of is on page 5, and this is as proposed in the original printing of the bill, subsection 6, it's the attorney's fees. We've had quite a bit of discussion about that. I imagine that you're aware of that as a committee as well, and that's kind of a sticking point that has been brought to our attention. So that's basically an overview. This is the status of where we're at. I will let you know that we have a work group meeting scheduled for next Wednesday, right after your committee meeting, as a matter of fact, to go through this version. What we will do, depending upon testimony you hear today, we will make adjustments if necessary and provide the stakeholders updated information Monday in preparation for discussion Wednesday, and then I'll be able to let you know where we're at as a result of those discussions, Mr. Chair. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long, my constituents, their question, I think we already know the answer, but I'm going to ask it because they sent me the note. What protects the purchaser of a new home with a warranty under this bill if the contractor declares bankruptcy or dissolves the business entity, which is recorded as the warrantor? There is
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not aware that there are. I know the CCB folks have more familiarity with how bankruptcy works than I do.
And just for point of information, does everybody in the committee have the proposed amendments?
Yeah, they hopefully, Mr. Chair, we provided a yellow folder that provides, yes, an overview, kind of the difference in the bill. And you have what we hope everybody else has. Again, this is our latest staff work. I want to let you know that there are some areas that we still need to clean up. But I think that this allows us to have a discussion document for which to get reaction from folks as opposed to continuing just kind of talking about things.
Representative Chair Hovey, Representative Nelson, my name is Bill Boyd. I'm the manager of the Dispute Resolution Program for the Construction Contractors Board. A warranty really is only as good as the company that backs it up, and if that company goes under and goes bankrupt, then whatever protections you have under the warranty that aren't available when the assets of the company are distributed are gone. The CCB fund is independent of bankruptcy, so to the extent that could help, that could step in. I don't really know of any other protections you would have. There might be a lawsuit under insurance available, and then the portion of the... Go ahead, Mark, and describe the third-party part of this.
Mr. Chair, I hesitate to think off the top of my head here in committee because I understand it's dangerous, but it's also possible, and I would need to check with folks in the insurance field, that if the contractor had a third-party insurance instrument, that there might be an avenue there. But I would need to check with folks that have a little bit better understanding of how insurance works.
Just a quick follow-up, please. The reason, you know, I think it's important for us to know this is because when we're signing this agreement with our contractor, you know, maybe we need to specify that he will also carry insurance. I mean, if we were concerned about his financial viability, we shouldn't be doing business with him, but maybe, you know, we want to. But the other one is, if the business, if it's a LLC, for example, if it was bought out or dissolved, I guess that's the other issue regarding the warranty. You know, does the warranty follow the builder or the contractor, I guess we're asking.
Are you familiar with that word?
I'd want to check with our counsel before answering that question.
But I appreciate it.
Representative
Thank you.
Nelson.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, as you probably can count, I'm one of the my vote isn't critical to this bill, probably, but my vote is going to hinge on three different avenues that I think need to be addressed. Number one is the right to opt out. And I think as a consumer, if you look at this as an extended car warranty, this, on the average, isn't going to be a good investment. And I think the consumer should have the right to opt out. That doesn't mean that I don't think that this shouldn't be, that they legally have to present this, but I think that the consumer, for me, has to have the right to opt out because this should be a direct pass-through cost. I personally like to do my own home repairs. I'm willing to take the risks, and therefore I could save some money by not having them to post a bond. The second thing is binding arbitration. For me, I think it's paramount to this bill. And then the third thing would be the right to repair. If you're a builder, on as far as within the warranty phase, I really think that you need to have the right to repair as part of the bill.
Can I ask Representative Girard, a clarification question, please.
Representative Bonamici, clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Girard, you said binding arbitration is important. You mean to have it in there or to not have it in there?
No, to have it in.
Thank you.
No, the testimony that we had was, I think, something to do with the fact that we were dealing with the definition of defect and that they were having trouble coming up with the definition of defect, and that he wanted basically the right to have it determined by the lawyers and the courts, and I just don't think that's a good idea. So I think if there's a dispute, I think that it needs to go to binding arbitration.
Further questions from the committee?
Perhaps I have one. I know we have another bill that we're considering around completed operations and product insurance. How would that coverage play with this warranty? Is it possible they could overlap and address some of the same things in this? Does one negate the need for the other, or do they cover different items?
Mr. Chair, Mark Long for the record. I'll give you my best shot at it. How's that sound of my understanding, and be happy to ask folks that have better understanding between the bonding market, insurance market, and how warranties work, which is something that I'm becoming familiar with as we work through this. But as my understanding is, they are, at least with the general liability policy, somewhat separate from the warranty piece. This is a first-party warranty that would be clarified in law what the builder is on the hook for and the time period that the builder is on the hook for. I don't know if the builder didn't fulfill one of the requirements to the extent his general liability policy would come in and help provide coverage, or if they had a third-party warranty instrument, how all that works, because the builder is the one. This is a first-party warranty where the builder is expressly warranting these things. And then I think those other pieces can help, but I don't know that they're directly related. I think I'm getting at your question. I don't know if you – that was my best shot.
Representative Holvey, typically – and I'm also no insurance expert – but typically insurance doesn't cover the removal, replacement, or repair of your own work. It may cover some other portion of the structure that was damaged through the contractor's negligence, but it doesn't cover the actual repair of your own work, and this warranty provision would.
So the completed product and operations insurance wouldn't, as you described, cover things that the warranty would.
Yes, Representative Holvey, the example I always use is the person who does a roof job, and it's the roof leaks. The removal and replacement of that roof would not be covered by the insurance, as I understand it. However, if that leaked down onto a hardwood floor and the hardwood floor got warped up, it would cover that.
And to follow up with Representative Nelson's questions around bankruptcy, do you know whether or not if a builder had this type of completed operations insurance, the builder declared bankruptcy, would that insurance still cover the building? And if you don't know, that's fine. We'll find out.
I don't know, Mr.
Not sure.
Okay.
Representative Holden.
All righty. Any other questions?
Just, Mr. Chair, just a quick little question when you have a chance.
Okay, just remember the ducks.
Yes.
I have a question.
No, go ahead.
I'm just concerned about if the whole facility isn't completed. You know, I mean, what are we warranting? The completion of this guy goes away from us. Is he warranting the completion of it per the contract, or just that portion that has been done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, again, this warranty is a first-party warranty clarifying the express obligations of the contractor. So, and this specifically lays out what the contractor's on the hook for. So my assumption is the completed operations insurance piece, again, is just a general liability policy. And we, with that earlier bill, kind of expanded the scope of it so that it covered not only work in progress, but after the fact. I don't believe there's a direct nexus between the contractor's general liability policy and this first-party warranty, and I need to double-check that, but I don't believe there is.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you for your introduction of this first bill. Appreciate your work and insights, as always. Next up, I have Richard Vile and Dean Aldridge, I believe. Hopefully I got your names right.
I think so.
You did.
Thank you, Chairman.
Chairman Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Rich Vile. I am a lawyer with the law firm of Vile Fotheringham in Portland. Our law firm focuses on homeowner association law. We represent about 1,500 condominium and homeowner associations in Oregon, approximately 300,000 residents of Oregon reside in the projects that we represent. At any given moment, about 35 to 40 of our projects will be involved in some kind of construction defect litigation. Approximately two-thirds of those relate to original construction problems, and the remaining one-third relate to replacement for older projects of roofs, decks, siding, etc. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2655, and I have just a couple of comments with respect to that. I do have a copy of the proposed amendments that the committee has given to this committee a moment ago. My concern is that if we limit the definition of a residential dwelling unit not to include units in structures that are four or more, there is a very large group of folks that need this, the benefit of this legislation, that will not get it. That group of folks are the folks that live in what we call townhouse-style homeowner associations. They are not registered under the Condominium Act. The Condominium Act does have a warranty in it, so those folks that live in condominiums already have a warranty. But the folks that live in a 150-unit townhouse project, where they may have 4 to 8 to 12 units per building, would not have any warranty protection at all. And so I would suggest that reconsideration of limiting this to 4 units or fewer be undertaken. In response to Representative Gerard's observation about binding arbitration, I would just like to make the observation that in 30 years of doing construction defect litigation, it has been my experience that arbitration has been no less expensive than litigation through the court system. They end up being about the same if it's quote-unquote binding arbitration. And therefore, I don't know that that would result in a significant benefit. We already have a right to repair statute that does apply to the kind of projects that I represent, as well as single-family homes. And we are already required to give notice to a contractor and give them the opportunity to come in and repair before any suit can be undertaken. Those are just a few comments, but generally I wanted to make sure that this committee knew that the groups that I represent were in support of this legislation.
Thank you. Do you have testimony too?
Yeah. Hi. My name's Dean Aldridge. I'm a lawyer as well. I'm somewhat the same, but a little bit different than Mr. Vile. I've got my own firm. We've got six lawyers, and we do For the most part, construction defect litigation. We also do standard construction claims, such as lien claims, payment claims, and so forth. We also represent contractors, developers, architects, and coverage disputes. We represent all sides, but mainly owners out of about 350 construction defect cases we've been involved with. About 275 of those have been on behalf of residential and commercial owners. The rest have been on behalf of contractors, suppliers, and so forth who get caught up in the web of construction defect litigation, and mainly from the standpoint of trying to get those folks coverage and get them out of it. We don't represent the insurance companies. I've got a degree in civil engineering from Oregon State. I've been practicing law for approximately 10 years now, and I also have some experience in the construction industry as a project manager for Milne Construction up in Portland for about 3 years before I went to law school, and I've also got experience with ODOT working as an engineer aide paying my way through college. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2655. I mean, it's got some problems, and we've been discussing some of the various issues, but the way I understand it, this sets up a bare minimum residential warranty requirement. Folks are able to contract for more, and they're free to do this, but I think the problem that this was supposed to solve is a lot of times when we're dealing with residential, single-family residential, and so forth, even townhomes, the way Mr. Pyle has testified to, the warranties are actually worse than you would get for a hairdryer or even a microwave, 90 days and with all kinds of exclusions. There are going to be some problems defining what a defect is. One thing I would look to is in the condominium statute, they do have a warranty against defects. And typically in these types of cases, you're not really arguing about what's a defect or not. You're worried about who's responsible and what the appropriate fix is for it. And I'm just going to kind of go through a few of the questions I had that various members of this committee have brought up. One is insurance coverage. And there's no way to mandate insurance coverage for these warranties. Typically, they'd be covered by the CGL or commercial general liability policy of the contractors, and only to the extent that it causes property damage. And, unless you want to mandate particular insurance coverage after a contractor may or may not go out of business, I don't think you're going to be able to solve that problem with this warranty. Again, this is, people are free to contract with who they want to, but, with respect to consumers, I think they need a bare minimum warranty requirement. But there's nothing that you can do that would mandate that a contractor has to stay in business for this long. I mean, what I do a lot of times in my commercial contracts or some of the bigger residential contracts I do when I do contract negotiations is through the contract I mandate that the contractor has to carry, insurance at least 2 or 3 years after the project's completed. And that's one way to solve that. And, that's kind of not really on the docket of the bills that I've seen that are out here, but that's one way to do it. And I think, if you wanted to look at some additional consumer protection, you may want to look at that because a lot of residential folks buying homes aren't able to think of that or hire a lawyer to be able to negotiate terms like that. Going to a question from Representative Nelson, as I view this warranty, it's not tied to substantial completion. Typically, contractors' warranties are tied to substantial completion, and if the contractor doesn't complete the work, I don't think there's any warranty for it unless it's done and it gets signed off as being complete. So that would be an add to this. And I think is, one of my concerns with this is to make sure that it is a bare minimum requirement. And going back to some... Is it Gerard?
Mm-hmm.
Questions that Representative Gerard has, the right to cure, that's already a statute that was passed, and that's on the books right now, where typically before a residential owner can bring any kind of action, whether arbitration or so forth, against a contractor, they have to provide them notice of whatever defects they think there are, and then that provides the parties a 90-day time frame, really, to try and work things out before anything can be filed, whether in arbitration or litigation. And I think, from my standpoint as a lawyer, both on the owner side and then from the contractor side, I think leaving the dispute resolution free to the contracting parties, I think, is good. Typically, as an owner, I like jury trials. Many times, as a defense, I like jury trials as well. Arbitration can sometimes be lengthy and, as Mr. Vile said, more expensive, but leave that to the parties. The parties can contract what their dispute resolution is going to be, and we've already got on the books right now a right to cure statute, which allows contractors to come back and try and fix things, and if they don't work it out, then you can take it to the next level. And I think that's about it for my comments. I mean, be free to answer any questions that y'all may have. But again, as a bare minimum requirement, I'm in favor of this. I think the attorney fee provision is a very substantial part of this, and I would recommend that you leave it in there, because that's one way in any transaction to get folks' attention, is if the party's going to lose, try and drag it out. That party's on the hook for attorney fees. That typically provides an incentive to get folks to work it out without a lot of rigmarole.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Aldrich's comments jogged my memory on one thing that I forgot to mention, if I may. The section on the time frames for bringing a claim has me somewhat troubled. And the reason for that is, particularly in the kind of projects that I represent, discovery of these problems often does not occur in the first or second year, and may, in fact, not occur until the fifth or sixth year, when the envelope is sufficiently compromised that the owner, who's focused on the interior of their unit because the association is maintaining the exterior, finally says to the association, hey, I'm getting a leak. My sheetrock's beginning to get wet, or my trim is swelling, or whatever it might be. And if that occurs 5 or 6 years downstream under the way this statute is written, I fear that we would have undone everything we intend to do by creating what is essentially an artificial limitation. It should be clear that this should be based on reasonable discovery, and reasonable discovery is something that there's an awful lot of case law on, and I don't think we should have to worry too much about trying to manage that in terms of the legislation. But rather than say it's a 1 year or 2 year or 10 year, it should say from reasonable discovery.
Thank you. So you already touched on one of my questions, which was the attorney fees in this piece. I've heard different things about the attorney fees on the prevailing party gets paid, I guess. And so you're thinking that is a positive thing for the consumers. I've also heard there may be a negative thing.
It's a positive thing for the consumers. Based in my experience in doing cases for consumers, one problem I've had in trying to get these cases to resolution is when you don't have the right to recover attorney fees, typically the cases will languish and the defense will drag them out and then try and use the fact that you can't get attorney fees as leverage to get a settlement that is more advantageous to them. I'm a big fan of the English rule, which is, if you're going to bring a suit, you got to put up or shut up, and you got to have a basis for it, and if you're going to win, you get your fees back. And I think that helps consumers. And if you look at most all consumer-oriented statutes, including the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in Oregon, it allows for prevailing party attorney fees, because I think it works to the consumer's advantage. I also think that it may get to one of Representative Girard's concerns, which is, what's a defect or what's not. I mean, certainly a consumer, if they're faced with a prevailing party attorney fee downside, they're not going to be suing a contractor over immaterial defects, a cracked tile, some a cabinet that the door doesn't swing right or what have you. So I think that the attorney fee provision, from my standpoint anyway, operates as kind of a filter to determine what's important and what's not. It also acts as an incentive to get these cases done sooner rather than later.
I would echo Mr. Aldrich's comments and offer the observation that most of the large cases, the type that we typically work on, do result in a settlement, and the insurance companies, if they're not exposed to an attorney fee downside, will inevitably drag them out much, much longer. And if we have an attorney fee provision that is available to the plaintiff, it often results in much earlier and much more attentive responses by the insurance companies that are often involved.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask one more question of you before I turn this over to the rest of the committee. You had some issues with the our residential definition of four, not more than four units. So where do you see that definition being expanded to? How far? I mean, clearly we have skyscrapers that are residential units at some point, and I'm not sure that the bulk of our complaints come from those sorts of units, but I do recognize, 12-unit townhomes might be an issue. But so I'm kind of curious where you think the line should be drawn.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I would be reluctant to choose a number and say, less than 500 or something like that. Remember that the skyscraper, if units are stacked, they have to be created pursuant to the condominium form of ownership, and we already have a warranty there. It is only when the units are in the townhouse style, where there's party walls, maybe common siding, usually common roofs, maybe common utility lines running through them, but it's not an artificial 100 or 200 or any other number. We have many projects that have 150, 200 units that have just as big a problem as a 12-unit project. I would suggest that the folks working on the bill look at ORS Chapter 94. ORS Chapter 94 is the Planned Community Act. And if that were the trigger, if a project was developed pursuant to the Planned Community Act or contained any interdependency between singly owned units, so that if you have to work with a homeowners association to effect repairs on the exterior of your unit, then it should apply to residential projects. That way it would not necessarily apply to what are just apartment complexes, pure single owner rental projects of multiple units, but it would apply to multiple unit projects that had individual ownership.
So you wouldn't put any limit on the height of them either? No,
I think that's unnecessary, because the Condo Act, if it's two stories or more, is going to cover the warranty requirements already. Anything that's two stories or more automatically is going to be a condominium. It can't be one of these planned community townhouse style projects.
Okay. And again, just to follow up, and again, with the condominiums, there is a warranty provided in the statute for new condominiums. I mean, one easy way around it is for all new residential units, unless otherwise covered in the condominiums, they get this warrant. Under the condominium statute, you get this kind of warranty, and that would make it easy. And then, if you've got a new residential unit, if you're a condominium, then you've got that warranty. If you're not a condominium, then you've got this warranty that you've included here.
I hate to admit it, but my competitor, Mr. Aldrich, has come up with a brilliant solution. That really is a good way to do it. Everything but condos, and then you've got them all covered.
And so you also mentioned the warranty. We currently have a 10-year statute of repose, and so do you see this warranty affecting that statute of repose, or does it make some of that statute?
It could add to confusion, and typically we see this in various forms. Many times a builder will provide a warranty either on a residential or a consumer project for a year or 2 years. After that time, basically the way I look is at the warranty and the way the courts have interpreted it is it's kind of a strict liability type of deal where if you got a problem, the builder will come back and fix it for free. If you're outside the warranty, then you can still, if the builder is not built the project right in the first place, you can still sue them for responsibility. They don't have to come back and fix it for free, and you also have to prove negligence on behalf of them. That's typically the way it works. That's the way a standard AIA contract, which is the industry standard for a lot of commercial and high-end residential contracts or projects, define it. And that's why I said this is a bare minimum. This is basically if you got a problem with something, and it kind of echoes in product liability too. You know, you've got a warranty for a car for a certain period of time, but if the car blows up and causes property damage or personal injury, you can sue under a different theory. That's kind of the same thing here. A warranty is the builder is going to come back and fix it for free for a certain period of time, and the warranty implies a repair obligation. After that warranty period is over, there's no repair obligation, and if you're going to have an action against a builder, you've got to prove that the thing was built wrong in the first place, and you've got to prove some kind of negligence rather than just a defect.
And probably the easy solution for this problem is to just simply make a statement in the legislation that says this is not an exclusive remedy and is not intended to replace other remedies that the consumer may have downstream. That way you get the benefit of a discovery period later for something that maybe couldn't have been discovered earlier during the warranty period.
Thank you.
And I believe under the terms of that, I'm trying to find it, but I did see a provision similar to that in the current proposal that is in front of you that we just got a copy of today.
You're a quicker reader than I haven't read it yet either.
And that's an important issue, and that's one that I looked at just to make sure that this was a minimum requirement. It gives the consumer some confidence within the project, but you know, if a building leaks after 2 years, then they're not out of luck in terms of trying to get a remedy.
Well, we'll certainly look for that. Right now, I'd like to open up to questions. From the committee, I've gotten a note that maybe I've asked too many.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Vile. Mr. Aldridge, I wonder if you could briefly explain what happens under a prevailing party statute when there are several claims made and the plaintiff prevails on some but not others.
And the classic example of that is, let's say you've got a breach of contract claim where you've got an attorney fee clause and then you've got a standard common law negligence claim. If you lose on the contract claim and you win on the negligence claim, you're still going to pay fees on the contract claim. The rule was amended, I think it's ORCP 69, recently, a few years ago, that it goes kind of claim by claim. So rather than, you know, kind of overall who wins, it's a claim-by-claim analysis. So, you know, if you prevail on a claim where you don't get fees and you don't prevail on a claim where you would be entitled to fees, you got to pay fees on that claim. And that's always something that, you know, you need to consider very carefully before you take one of these things up.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee?
Okay.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you both for being here, Mr. Ball. I know you're not the authors of this proposed amendment. In fact, I don't know who is.
Building codes.
Okay. Building codes. But anyway, if you look on page 7, and would you tell me what section 8B2A means to you?
B2A.
Yeah, it's the Harris. Recently, the Oregon Court of Appeals decided a case we call it Harris, Harris versus Suniga, I think, mm-hmm. is the name of the case, isn't it? That
Harris, excuse me, versus?
Versus Suniga, S-U-N-I-G-A.
Okay.
And in Harris versus Suniga, the question was, or one of the questions was, does a subsequent purchaser have the same rights as the original purchased person who was in contract with the builder? And there's a lot of discussion both in that case and a subsequent case, Bunnell, and I can't remember what the back half of the Bunnell case is, that would call into question whether or not under a warranty claim a subsequent purchaser had the benefit. I read this to mean that the legislature's specific intent was to require the builder to continue to honor that warranty even though it may be sold to a subsequent purchaser. Now, if that's not the intent, I'm concerned, but that's how I read it.
And that's how, without referring to the case, that's how I read it. It's the limitations and the benefits apply to subsequent purchasers of the structure, whether it's done in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years.
A follow-up, just to finish this up, please.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Thank you. I appreciate this, and I think this is very important, probably the most important thing in this whole amendment, because we seem to get in and out of properties here and very frequently. I think it's important that we specify when those benefits. The time allowance for those benefits. In that, did the warranty initially start the day the original buyer moved in, the day the subsequent buyer moved in, the day the, and I don't know how we specify those things, but would you, if you were looking at this as it is, would you think that the subsequent buyer just picks up? I don't see any wording that moves that all in together.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, Mr. Aldridge and I are both representing usually consumers in the cases that we bring, but frankly, at least I know I consider myself and by reputation Mr. Aldridge, we don't feel like we're kind of the ambulance chasers, meaning we'd like to expand this as far as absolutely possible so that,
right.
Builders are just stuck no matter what. It does require a recording, so that would set a date.
Okay.
It does say that failure to record doesn't invalidate the warranty, but at least by requiring a recording, it sets a date, so you know when it was placed on there. And because I believe the 10-year statute of ultimate repose does serve an important purpose in our system, I would personally be reluctant to say that the 1-2 year provision started over on a subsequent sale. So I think the answer is, as written, it's pretty clear. It's going to start when that warranty is recorded, which is probably usually going to be on the date of that first sale, and that's going to be the time that it runs. And if it's not recorded, it's still in place. You just may have to fight about when it actually started.
Thank you.
And I think you would refer to the 10-year statute of ultimate repose, which Mr. Vile talked about, which is 12-135, which sets the 10-year period. And I know in different committees there's a war going on a little bit about whether there's going to be a change from the 10-year with regard to certain property owners or commercial and so forth.
The proposal to drop to six?
Yeah, that's a different, that's not
it's not in these.
Right.
But I think we stick with 12-135, which is 10 years. In kind of an overall view coming in from both as a contractor and representing different folks, the easy solution, so we don't have to deal with this kind of legislation and nitpicking about it, is if projects last 10 years, which I don't think is unreasonable for the construction industry. People pay a lot of money for the construction industry brings in a lot of money. That's because people pay a lot of money for buildings and homes. If the projects last 10 years without substantial problems, then we don't have to worry about this. But right now we're caught in a period where, you know, we're trying to proceed on, and I think, you know, one of the overall views of the legislation is going to, you know, we need to kick the industry a little bit to get these quality measures in place. And one thing we certainly don't want to do is ratchet back protection for folks who are paying for these construction services.
In case I get hit by a bus and don't make it back when you're hearing that bill, I'm also in favor of not shortening it, staying with the 10-year statute of ultimate repose.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask one more question, just so you can put some clarity, I guess, in your discussion of the time frame of the warranty, where we're talking about 2 years for complete coverage of the building, and or no, it's 2 years of systems and envelope and, you know, those sorts of things, and then 10 years for the structure, and I think just 1 year of complete coverage of most items from defects. So, and you seem to say that we shouldn't put a time frame on those items. I don't know if I heard you right, but and that you just would refer to reasonable discovery.
Well, Chair Holvey, members of the committee,
can you clear up my thoughts on that?
Yeah, let me see if I can. It was probably my confusion, and I apologize for that. If the bill contains, and I probably didn't read it as closely as Mr. Aldrich did, a specific provision that it does not prevent or preclude any other rights that the consumer may have to pursue legitimate claims, then I don't have a problem with these short time frames for, as Mr. Aldrich called them, strict liability. I think 1 year on general cabinet doors and doorknobs and that sort of thing is fine. I think 2 years is too short on the envelope. If it were me, I would lengthen that probably to at least 4 to 6 years. But regardless of whether we do that or not, if the bill contains the language that says it doesn't preclude other claims, I'm not troubled by it.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee? I want to thank both of you for taking the time out of your day to be here and share your testimony with this committee. I really appreciate it. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2655? Mr. Scott Berry, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'll try to make this short. I went to the University of Oregon, and I too have some concerns about the late time of day.
Yeah, gosh, I'm just really gloomy about that. looks like I'm going to miss
lots of questions already. Scott Berry again with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and we have some serious concerns about House Bill 2655. I think initially going into this process, we were looking at a warranty as a possible solution to some of our concerns and a way to make sure the consumer remained whole and the problems got fixed. What we ended up with here, I believe, is a scenario under which we cover certain parts under a warranty, free from any defects in workmanship or materials for 1 year, then we do it for 2 years on other parts of the house, and then in the end, as the two gentlemen just mentioned, really we're still on the hook for 10 years for all of that stuff. So it's a bit of a step backwards in an era when liability insurance rates are extremely high, and part of the goal of this task force was to address that. And I don't mean address that by removing the burden to the contractor to protect the consumer for a product that was built, but this seems to certainly go the opposite direction in terms of putting us in a scenario under which those liability rates could again go through the roof. So what we're being asked to do, and if I'm reading the bill correctly, is to cover items that we cannot get insurance for. So if at some point we retire, die, move to another state as a contractor, those items are still there. And if I'm retired as a contractor and we have a problem with a siding product that is based on something that was potentially a problem in the manufacturing of that product, we have to warranty against that, despite the fact that there may be an exclusion in the insurance policy which does not cover it. So, but one other thing I'll mention, and that is with regard to the comments made by Mr. Jacobson, who was talking about the British Columbia system, which in many ways this system of a warranty was initially looked at as something we might pattern after. And his comments, I don't know if you remember his comments, but he was with the architects, and what he said was the only way this works is if there is exclusive remedy for the repairs. And that certainly does not exist here with what we believe is, again, an easier standard to sue the contractor for under this warranty. And then one final thing. I've heard a little bit about right to repair and right to cure. We do not have right to cure or right to repair in this state. What we have is the opportunity to offer to repair, which simply can be turned down by the consumer and off you go to court. So I just wanted to clarify that final thing. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair. The question that I brought up before was the right to opt out, because this, to me, is a direct pass-through for the consumer. Do you have a problem with being able to negotiate a contract, and if they don't wish to be part of the extended warranty, you don't have a problem with them having the right to opt out?
Chair Hobie, Representative Girard, no, I would think that would at least be, I would think a lot of our folks may opt out of this particular type of a warranty.
Yeah.
So
because of cost.
That's correct. Yeah. Because they may not be able to get liability insurance with it, but certainly for some contractors.
Further questions? Well, let me follow up on that one, Arso, and with Representative Girard, too. So your right to opt out would be exercised by the builder or by the consumer, or either?
Well, the initial, Representative or Chair Holby, the initial bill that allowed for that burden and benefit statute, which was brought up a few minutes ago, was optional to the consumer and the contractor. In other words, the contractor was allowed to put a benefit burden clause in their contract. And I think that's something we were very supportive of last session. And in terms of opting out of this, if it were to go through, I guess that would be, in its current form, that would be better than not being able to opt out.
Did you answer my question?
I think he opted out of answering your question.
I have a bill about this.
Yeah.
Is it called plain talk?
It is. Sure. Charlie, I would be happy to answer your question if you want to ask it again.
Any further questions? Thanks, Mr. Berry, for your testimony. Any further testimony on House Bill 2655?
Mr. Chair, recognizing that there is 1 minute to go, I will be very, very brief.
Well, I got a few more bills, so it's hopeless.
Mr. Chair, Jessica Adamson for the record with Associated General Contractors, and I just want to say that we support the definition that's contained in the proposed amendments. The CCB statute currently defines the difference between residential, small commercial, and large commercial in the same way that and it's structured in a way that's similar to the definition in this bill. There are rights that are extended to homeowners in that statute in terms of dispute resolution with the CCB that mirror the definitions here. So to change those we believe would cause confusion, and certainly we believe consistency is good. So we'd be concerned about different definitions. I think this is appropriate definition in maintaining consistency with other definitions in that statute, and rights that are extended to homeowners in that statute, and claims processes similar to that.
Okay.
ask a clarification if I talk really fast?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, Jessica. I just want to make sure I understand. You do not agree with the suggestion we heard earlier about everything that's not a condo, and you prefer the definition that's in the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So Jessica, how would we cover some of these other townhouse type units where there are 12 units hooked together, for example, if in fact we stick with that four unit residential statute and they're not condominiums, they're just then outside of the warranty scenario altogether. So there is no. I'm just trying to figure out how do we deal with that type of construction then.
Mr. Chair, AGC is together with the Building Trades Council is bringing forward a really marvelous piece of public policy, House Bill 3242, that includes a warranty for those projects, and it would be a building envelope warranty for new construction for 2 years that would begin to cover that. And secondarily, I would say that when you're talking about a structure of that size or what I believe were referred to projects that have 150 townhomes in them, you are talking a very different level of construction. You aren't on a contract basis with a single-family residential consumer. You are on a contract basis with a developer, and then later on with a condominium an association of some sort that maintains the envelope of that building. The envelope isn't left, and the structure isn't left to necessarily individual owners. So you're talking a very different level of contract, of leverage, and so it's not the same as a single-family residential. It's a different level of sophistication. It's a different level of contractor. It's a different relationship. So the protections in the contracts look very different.
And so you think that provisions that are in this bill are covered by your House Bill 3244? Is that what you said?
3242 does not have a 10-year structure warranty. It does have a 2-year building envelope warranty.
Okay. Any other questions for Jessica? Appreciate your testimony and keeping us up to date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other testimony for House Bill 2655? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2655 and open a hearing on House Bill 2656. Go Ducks. Steve, would you give us a brief little summary of House Bill 2656?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2656 establishes a certification system for building envelope specialists and building envelope installers.
Thank you. Mark Long, you want to come up and give us just a brief preview of...
Sure.
Or maybe I shouldn't say brief. Maybe you should just give us a preview of the proposed amendments to 2656 and how that changes this bill.
For the record, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes, House Bill 2656 is a Construction Claims Task Force recommendation dealing with increasing, if you will, the training requirements for folks who work on building envelopes. What you should have in front of you is a document dated March 16th, 2007 in my staff update packet, and I will provide you the same disclaimers that I provided on the other bill, which is this is our work in progress, and just wanted to have something in front of you and other folks to kind of react to so that we could be on the same page. What we've done different from the bill that came out originally that you heard testimony on is we've removed all the reference to the certificate of occupancy. There was some question about that. And if you recall, on Wednesday, the language relating to certificates of occupancy, which is a kind of a permitting requirement, is in House Bill 2657, which is the CCB notification. So we didn't feel we needed to put it in multiple places, and so we removed that out. The other thing that's different in Section 5 of this bill, the bill originally proposed had a two-tiered certification system, kind of a supervisory level, if you will, and then an individual level. This is at the contractor level. So it has removed that second tier, if you will, and we're basically going by what is in Section 5, that a licensed contractor that works on a building envelope is going to have to obtain the services either through direct employment contract or some other mechanism of a building envelope specialist who would then verify the work and provide that that observation document to the local building department. And the reason why the certificate of occupancy is important, because the local building department would not give occupancy until that document was provided to the building department. Section 7 is probably part of the key pieces of the bill, of the language that we have in front of you. It's on page 2, and this is where we provide broad rulemaking authority for the Construction Contractors Board to establish the certification program, set standards for training providers. It's our belief through the task force that there are many third-party entities out there already that provide for certification of building envelope specialists, if you will, and we think that that's a positive way to go, but we need to set standards for the approval of those programs, what will be contained in those programs, and then break those programs down by particular types, and I'll share that with you here in a little bit. Additionally, in Section 7, if you kind of move on to 7A, we set up a committee. It is a one-time committee that helps the Construction Contractors Board set up the rules around establishing those procedures for the third-party providers and the training standards, and you can see the layout of that. When you get to Section 8, this is what we're really talking about. This is the duty of the certified building envelope specialist. We're proposing, at least with this particular draft, that there's one for exterior finishes, which is really the custom exterior work, for roofing, and then one that for the siding, windows, and doors. After an individual was certified and a contractor did work in these areas, that individual would provide a, and I'm going to look for the exact language here, completed quality assurance checklist to the building department indicating that they'd looked at the work and it was satisfactory. Essentially, that's the bulk of the certification requirement. The other piece that's in here that was in the original bill is in Section 9. We're requiring continuing education for all general contractors, all contractors. So there's really two different things going on here. Certification, a requirement to obtain the services of a certified envelope specialist to make sure that that envelope was installed properly, provide that quality assurance checklist, if you will. But we're also requiring all contractors to have continuing education requirements, and we accomplished that in Section 9. So obviously it would apply to building envelope, but as well as contractors in other areas of construction. The rest of it provides for some authorities for CCB to take action and local government inspectors to check for certifications and licenses and those kinds of things, just as an enforcement mechanism. I'll tell you, there's been some questions about manufactured housing, you know, whether or not they're included in this or not. And, you know, manufactured housing is under the federal program up until the time that it's first sold to the consumer and the contract has been completed. So our intent would be to, and it's not abundantly clear in this draft, but our intent would be to make sure that they don't fall under that umbrella, and that's pretty consistent in the way that we regulate construction as a whole. That's my brief overview, Mr. Chair. Also in the document, we do provide bullet points for the committee, kind of just describing the differences, and I'd be happy to take any questions if you have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about Section 5.
Sure.
And it appears to me that you have gone from requiring everyone who touches the envelope to be certified to the other extreme of only one person in the company has to have that certification. I was hoping we'd find some middle ground where one person on a project had to have that certification. Why did we skip all the way back?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, what we're attempting to do here is indicate that the contractor has to get the services of at least one individual in one of those three areas, depending on the work that they do, because in the trades, not every contractor does windows and doors and siding and those kinds of things. So we wanted to provide training to those individuals. But if I'm a contractor and I work in that area, and I do, let's just say siding, that's the easiest to work with, I have to obtain the services of one individual to be on the site to make sure that it's, and I think the terms in here are, it's completed substantially, let me look here, observed to a substantial degree as defined by the board, that would be the CCB board, how that installation went, and then provide that quality assurance checklist to the building department. That was kind of the compromise piece to, as opposed to all installers and trying to direct contractors to employ. Some indicated they wouldn't be able to do that. This would allow a kind of a flexible approach.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up, Representative Riley.
But the way I read the new Section 5 is that a contractor, no matter how many projects he has doing siding, mm-hmm. he only has to have one envelope specialist. And I...
Potentially.
Yeah, and
yes. Yes, Representative.
I mean, you see where I'm going. Is there any possibility we'll get back to some middle ground where each project that's ongoing have one on site while that work is going on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, you bet. Again, this is the kind of the latest work in progress, trying to capture the collective input from folks with different interests, obviously. And what we were trying to do is, it's difficult sometimes to, the challenge is, I shouldn't say it's difficult, the challenge is to determine what does it mean to be on site, how often, how many projects, as you suggest, how do you deal with that, what happens if they're not there, ratios. And so the idea that came forward was to not provide that level of specificity, but provide for that verification list so that that specialist for that project is going to have to sign off that it's acceptable, and then we tie that into the certificate of occupancy, and that isn't issued until that document is provided to the local building department. So it is a shift, but I wanted to kind of hopefully clearly explain the concept, and we'll be discussing this again, I'm sure, on Wednesday with the various interest groups, and I appreciate your input. Okay.
Questions, Representative Gilliam.
Representative, do you have a question?
Yes.
Please go ahead.
No, the chair
insists
you go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's not what I said, but go ahead.
Am I proceeding?
Yes.
There could be the second quarter, and you're kind of...
You know. I'm sorry, and I'm dawdling. What I have as much sympathy as I can for you, but my Warner Pacific Knights have already been to their national tournament and went out in the second round. But there is TiVo. Okay. So here's my question to you. These are all very important bills, but this is the one that I have the most excitement about. And I wanted to get your sort of feeling in terms of priority, and the reason for that is this. It seems to me, even with problems that we need to work out, like my friend here pointed out, if we get through 56 before these others, we start the process of moving forward. You know, there's a lot of stuff to work out, but this one seems to me to get at the root of the envelope, which was very well defined, I think, in the early testimony, and start a process where we start moving forward and improving the actual work, therefore eliminating the problems. Would you agree that this is, if not the number one bill of the package, at least a high priority?
Chair Representative Gillen, you bet. And, you know, I don't want to suggest any of the other ideas that came from the task force were less important than another idea. Training and education and oversight of construction work and doing that as it's being built, I think, is one of the best things that you can do to help prevent problems that occur after the fact that you're attempting to address with warning, other kinds of things. Seems like dealing with it up front would be the way to go about it.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, who do you work for?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, Department of Consumer Business Services. I run the Building Codes Division.
Okay, if you would look on page 2 mm-hmm. of your proposed amendment, I'm just we go from May to Shell to Will, and that's why I was wondering who you worked for, because maybe you were concerned about telling them that they will do this, and you didn't want to. However, then when I read through this in other places, you tell them that they shall, and so I think Section 7 has to be changed to say they will do this or we're not going to have this program.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, are you talking about the responsibilities of the construction contractors?
Section 7.
Yeah, Section 7.
First line, you know, where you're telling them they may adopt rules to do this and enforce the system. But the way, as I understand it, this whole bill is that they will do this because this is the new plan.
I think
they'll have a choice.
I agree with you. This is the plan, and it's not a well, we won't do it if we don't want to. I think the issue, Representative Nelson, is that there are multiple ways to accomplish the goal, and wanted to provide the maximum flexibility to the board to provide that goal. Third, competent, qualified third-party certification organizations is a viable option, and it's used in many of the areas. We have it in our system over at Building Codes. But we also have direct certification and licensing programs that we administer. And I think what we're trying to accomplish, and maybe we need to go back and sharpen our pencil, was to allow the board to figure out what's the best way to go. And if there wasn't an adequate, competent third-party program, to then be able to implement it themselves. The goal is to get that quality program. And you are dealing with a new area in Oregon where we don't have these things yet. So that was really the intent. Not that we would never do this. It's that how you do it, whether it's through outside sources or directly from the agency, needs to be worked out.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Mr. Chair, yes. Thank you very much. I did not realize there were third-party people that were specialized in this. Thank you very much, and that's a great shirt.
Thank you.
Green,
go Ducks.
Green.
Yeah. Yes. That was a lot better than Oregon.
Go Ducks.
Representative Gerard.
Oh, that's insulting. For that, I might take 10 minutes. Actually, I have a quick question. It goes to Section 5.
Sure.
And it has to do with satellite installers, security system installers, all those people that kind of come secondary. I'd like to know how that's going to intertwine with this. And if by my reading Section 5 that you're working on, that they would have to hire a building envelope specialist or be one themselves. And, you know, they can go through the roof, they can go through the siding, they can go through, I don't know, it just seems like they would have to have almost all three of them.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gerard, it's not the task force intent to get at the kind of the cable installations or the, I would call, minor level penetrations in the building envelope and require certification. We're really talking about, and we might need again to work on this, but we're really talking about folks that are installing siding, windows, doors, roofing, those kinds of things. We're not attempting to get at the cable, phone, I'm trying to think of somebody else that would be involved in that. That wasn't the intent of the task force.
Well, let me just follow up real quick. We had testimony about I can't remember if it was a security system, I believe, where they actually drilled through the bottom part of the window, you know, to put the wires through, which is pretty common, and that caused the leakage to the envelope, which caused the problem. So. I can appreciate the fact you don't want to deal with that, but maybe if you're going to put everybody on the hook, I kind of would like to make sure that the people on the hook are the ones that did the problem.
Chair Holder, Representative Gerard, I do agree with you that the people that caused the problem should be on the hook. I think that from an implementation standpoint, and again, this is new, felt that the task force felt the difference, and I actually agree that it would be difficult to cast that overly broad brush the first time out with this type of program. And it's our belief that the majority of the problems that we heard from consumers were in new construction, traditional siding, window, door installation. Decks as well is a key piece. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to suggest that it never happens that these other specialty contractors or subcontractors cause a problem, but we're really trying to get our arms around the majority of what we saw from the consumers as the issue.
Did you say decks or ducks?
I heard ducks.
I did too.
No. duck work.
Duck work.
It's 9 pounds.
Special.
So, Mark, I don't see anybody else jumping in on the questions.
Sure.
Since you mentioned decks, you know, I've kind of wondered a little bit from time to time. Do we have documentation of decks being installed as being a problem after the fact sometimes of piercing the envelope and causing a water intrusion problem?
Chair Holby, you know, one of the things I think you're going to hear a bill on Monday talk about getting data information. Do we have data? No. Do we have anecdotal and do we have customer testimony? Yes. And we had folks come in to talk to us. I don't remember their names off the top of my head. Contractors coming in and going back after decks were installed and significant damage to residential structures that they had to fix at cost to the consumer. So based on what the task force heard, which is not scientific, and I can't tell you the percentage and how widespread it is, that deck installations were a concern of the task force because it becomes an easy point for water to get into the structure. So I hope I answered your question. But data, no, and I hope that we can work on that with the bill on Monday.
Mr. Boyd, you can either come forward or nod if you don't. Do you have any knowledge of decks as being an issue?
It's the same. Mark's answer was perfect.
The reason I ask that question is because we also have landscape contractors that are able to install decks and attach these things to homes, and I don't think they fall under the construction contractors board. And I'm wondering, I don't believe this bill really addresses landscape contractors and their decks either. And is that an area that we need to look at, or in your opinion, or not?
Mr. Chair, I believe that we've covered it, and I would, you know, defer to folks that provide us better legal advice, but by using the broad term contractor, it may include the folks at the Landscape Contractors Board. I think they're defined as contractors. I don't know that, but I think they are.
If I may, I know that the landscape contractors think they're covered under this.
That's
encouraging.
Yeah. Well, I believe that they are, but...
Okay. And I've just got one more comment, and you know I'm probably going to echo what Representative Riley said. I am a little bit concerned over the certification specialist, and that specifically I'm worried about us. You know, we recognize the impracticality of certifying everybody that works on the envelope, and given that, I'm also concerned that we create a third party, not that we can't, but create a third party that's going to go around and just sell their signature, and really, even though it says here in the bill they're going to substantially observe, they're not really involved in the installation process. And so, you know, if a contractor is involved in doing this type of work, it seems like that they would want to have one of their people be certified as a specialist and be on the project when they're actually doing the installation, so that they can put their John Henry on it saying it's been installed correctly. And so I'm just a little bit nervous about the concept. I'm not saying I don't like it altogether. I'm just saying I'm a little bit nervous about the potential for abuse of this, and what do we really get at the end of the day if the people installing it really haven't been trained to do it, and we just have some guy walking around putting his signature on it, because I don't know if that person actually ultimately has any liability other than, you know, his reputation with his signature.
So I'm just a little concerned about that scenario, I suppose.
Well, Chair Holby and Representative Riley, I appreciate your concerns, and obviously when we get into the work group on Wednesday, we're going to make sure, I think people here have heard those, but we'll make sure that they're brought forward and try to figure out a model that goes a little bit more robust than where we're at, but maybe not where the bill originally was. So, again, work in progress.
Or you just have to convince me that it works, I suppose. So anyway, with that,
we're new ground. So,
yeah. thank you. Next up, I'll have the attorney team of Richard Vile and Dean Aldrich again.
Yes.
Chair Holby, member of the committee, Rich Vile, Attorney Portland, and I just have very few comments on this bill. Don't have a huge dog in this fight because on the size projects that our firm represents, this is probably not going to be the thing that makes it happen well or not, but we would support the idea. We believe that the more education that contractors can be given and the more requirement to certify on envelope, the better off we are likely to be. Envelope is without a doubt responsible for 80 to 90% of all of the problems that we deal with in construction defect litigation in the projects that I represent. And just in response to a comment that I heard a moment ago, the deck to building interface is often, and I would say in probably 75% of the cases, a major trouble spot. So that deck installation issue is a huge one. Thank you.
Dean Aldrich, I echo Mr. Vile's comments about this. I think it's a good deal, and I would agree with Representative Gilliam that this is probably the best one out of the bunch in terms of trying to be proactive and solve problems with the least amount of government interference or changing the statutes and rules of responsibility and so forth in these matters. I do echo your concern, though, Chairman, about having the third-party inspectors kind of go out and sell their signatures. I've seen that in a few circumstances so far. Basically, the market is actually doing this on a lot of the larger projects already, requiring the insurance companies and the financing companies are requiring independent inspectors to come out and do this kind of work. But we need to make sure, and maybe the work group can deal with this, make sure those folks are adequately insured with E&O coverage, which will separate out the folks who want to take this seriously versus the folks who will just sell their signatures. But again, I view this as a great step in the right direction.
And if you could clarify for those of us who aren't really great with acronyms, what's an E&O?
Errors and omissions, which is different from a commercial general liability policy, which most design professionals and consultants need to have. A lot of home inspectors have error and omissions, which when they make a mistake, it covers for that mistake, not necessarily their work. They're not doing hands-on work. It's a different type of insurance policy than typically what a contractor has.
Thank you. I recognize it now. Questions from the committee? Again, appreciate your testimony. Next up, I have Sean Miller and Scott Berry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and CNA Western Surety. And just want to start out by saying that I think we're here today in support of House Bill 2656, and I think some of the comments here today and prior with Representative Gilliam's comment on probably the one most important piece of legislation. When I sat through all of those meetings in the interim and heard all of the claims, water intrusion, issue was around the envelope. That is where the issues are in construction defects. And this particular bill, I think, will go a long way in solving that problem. The work group, I think, looked at several things in Section 8 of the bill when dealing with the exterior finish specialists roofing specialist, siding, window, and door specialist. We combined siding, window, and door specialist. Originally, there was four different kinds of specialists. We felt that that was probably appropriate. I think to address Representative Riley's questions, I think that we're still going to have that discussion in the next work group. But I think, what is appropriate on the job site and so forth. And so I think from the standpoint of my organizations and looking at what I think this committee and consumer protection, if you were to use one bill and then build around that bill, it would be this one. And I think in addressing the problem. And so I commend the work. And I think a lot of the stuff I think in Section 7 that Representative Holvey put in putting this group together at CCB to develop the rules and allow that flexibility in developing those rules, I think could go a long way in solving some of those issues as well. So I think that is also a good idea. In addressing one of the comments on the third party and the requirement that insurance companies may require in those situations where there is a building envelope consultant on the job, they're very specialized in that. I think I would also agree with what the prior panel and the attorney said on trying to differentiate between those that are there to actually be a part and those that are just selling their signature. And so I think we would agree with that comment, something that we would like to address in the work group next week. But again, here to support the bill, and I think it's the most important bill in this package, and I think there's some small things that you can build around it. But I'll leave my comments at that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Berry.
Good afternoon again. For the record, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And we also are very supportive of House Bill 2656. I think, again, look forward to the work group coming up later next week. And in terms of fine-tuning some of the concerns I think we've heard here today. And again, and Mr. Miller just mentioned this, the E&O insurance for any third-party inspectors would be another real good idea, although I think our intention with the single-family home is to have actual trained subcontractors with multiple supervisors potentially on the site. But and maybe to answer Representative Riley's question, we could envision a scenario where one trained individual was on the job site where the siding is not going on at the same time as the roof and the windows aren't going in at the same time as the siding or the roofing. So potentially that may work, but again, that those details need to be figured out. But overall, I think we're real happy with the progress of this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Just one. I guess I'm hung up on decks today. And I did say decks, but I'm kind of curious about what your take on since we've heard decks being a problem, and oftentimes the construction of decks involved, I guess, taking the envelope back off and basically making a substantial penetration in the envelope, and how that's got to be done. I'm worried about, I guess, the actual construction and how we're going to enforce this with the landscapers also doing this same type of work. And I'm just concerned about the expertise that's involved in all of these things and how we're going to police this. And hopefully our bill does address, both the landscape contractors doing this type of work and the construction contractors. I'm just curious if you have any insights from your association, if you've heard any issues about, deck construction and faulty decks as such causing problems in the industry.
Yeah, Chair Holvey again, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders. That has been a concern for us, and not only as it relates to a landscape contractor coming out, but also the homeowner being able to put a deck on their own house, and depending on how high that deck is, maybe not pulling a permit for that. So there are issues surrounding that, and I think the homeowners, they address their own home, may put more effort into that, but we would certainly support education for anyone who is working with that envelope, because in the end, I think that first call probably comes back to the general contractor who built the house in the first place.
Mr. Chairman, if I may comment on that as well, I think our intention, I think landscape contractors would be considered and regulated under Chapter 701, and that they would be included in this bill as well. However, when looking at Section 13 of the definition of building envelope, it says that intended to separate and protect the interior space of the structure from the adverse effects of the climate. So I'm not sure, based on that definition, and I guess I question Mark and some of the others involved in the work group, if that really is addressed in the bill. And so I think it's a question that we need to bring back to the work group.
Thank you for that. I appreciate your testimony again. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2656? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2656 and open the hearing on House Bill 2658. Steve, would you give us a brief little summary of House Bill 2658?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2658 establishes the Oregon Construction Defect Limited Assistance Fund.
Thank you. Again, may we have Mark Long from the Building Codes Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for the State of Oregon come forward and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Mark Long with State Building Codes Division. I'm here to talk about House Bill 2522. No, that's the score of the Ducks game. 2658 is a...
Which one?
Oregon. House Bill 2658 is a construction claims task force bill, and it's brought to you to provide limited assistance to consumers when there is a shortfall, either through contractor assets or bonding or insurance. You obviously had an original hearing on this bill. Again, this is work in progress. There is considerable interest in this bill, and there are folks that have pretty strong feelings about the viability of the program. But that aside, let me talk to you about what we've done since last time we met. In Section 2, I think the key issues are, again, defining what a defect is, and that is the same issue that we would have in the warranty bill, and then the definition of residence, which is the same issue that we would have in the warranty bill. And I can just share with you that what we just discussed in the warranty bill, as far as definitions are supposed to be, at least for the purpose of this discussion draft, the same. We're really trying to look at owner-occupied structures. It's important to clarify that so that this isn't necessarily made available to investment opportunities. And if you recall, the idea of this fund is to take the existing revenue that's in the system. You may remember that the Construction Contractors Board collects civil penalties when they take an action against a contractor. And those civil penalties under current Oregon law are transferred to the general fund minus an administrative charge. What this does is keep those civil penalties back at the Construction Contractors Board in this limited assistance fund and makes those dollars available to consumers on a prorated basis with caps up to $20,000 per consumer, $100,000 maximum per contractor, available to the consumers. And, you know, the estimates go anywhere from, if you look at the shortfalls historically with this fund and the bond changes that are being discussed and other items, 20 cents on the dollar up to maybe 50 cents on the dollar from those shortfalls that were experienced in our last known, our last data that we have, which I think is 05, isn't it, for that, or 04?
Yeah, it's
05. 05, okay. Anyway, this will be part of the work group. I think the chair is aware and the committee is aware there are, I guess I can't stress this enough, there are some fundamental differences of opinion about whether this is a good idea or not that's been shared with us from the various interest groups, and they can communicate those issues to you. For us, I think the main issue is defining defect, determining who it applies to, you know, what level of resident structure, whether it's larger structures or the four units, and how to deal with the funding in the general fund piece. I guess there's one other issue that came up that I will bring to your attention. And I'll see if I can find it here quickly under Section 3. Ah, here it is. If you go to page 2, there was also a concern brought forward to us that this, as drafted, would allow a consumer that was not part of the CCB process. The CCB process allows consumers to file a claim within the first year. Then thereafter, you go through either an arbitration process or a court judgment process. The way this is drafted, it would allow qualifying consumers for qualifying projects to come in and access, if available, the limited assistance fund if they had a court judgment or arbitration award. And some folks have suggested that should be limited to just the CCB one-year process. I don't know if I've made that clear. It's kind of a it's basically the scope of who would qualify. Is it available for consumers that are within that CCB one-year process, or is it available for those that have gone around that or after that CCB process through the court system or through an arbitration? That's something that is going to have to be decided at the end of the day, and there seems to be some interest in ferreting that out. With that, hopefully I've covered this bill and the score of the game, and I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Yeah, you scored a few points with me. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Every group in the state wants a dedicated fund.
Very good.
That's that plain language.
Further questions or
plain statements?
Mark, you mentioned something about this assistance fund and whether or not somebody who is not eligible to be in the CCB claim process being able to access this fund. In the Construction Claims Task Force, did they discuss at all the length of time of 1 year of the CCB claim process being changed?
Mr. Chair, the short answer is no. The only time that it was discussed was when notification wasn't provided to the consumer. You may remember the bill we heard on Wednesday, and then extending that by a year if those notices weren't provided. That was the extent, my recollection, of changing that claim time period.
Okay.
You guys remember anything different?
No.
Thank you for your testimony today. I appreciate it. Next up, Richard Weil and Dean Aldrich.
Chair Holme, members of the committee, I'm going to put one additional hat on. I'm Richard Weil, lawyer in Portland. The additional hat I'm going to put on right now is a member of the Legislative Action Committee for Community Associations Institute. Community Associations Institute is a national organization advocating on behalf of homeowners in condominium and planned community projects, represents several million residents around the country. We approximate about a million residents of the state of Oregon may be residing in the projects that the Community Associations Institute represents. This bill is wonderful from the standpoint that it does provide yet another opportunity for the consumer to get some benefit from the contractor, but it completely excludes all homeowner associations. Condos are gone. Planned communities, the townhouse units, the 12-unit townhouse units, nobody's going to get any benefit out of this at all. Now, that's not even considering the fact that we've got a $100,000 cap on a contractor and $20,000 cap per consumer. The $20,000 cap per consumer doesn't bother us. Take a typical situation where you've got a building with a bad envelope and there are 100 units and it's a $5 million problem, $20,000 a unit goes a long ways to helping do that. But obviously, if you're cutting off at $100,000 for the whole year for a single contractor, there's not going to be much assistance that's given to those multi-unit projects. We do not understand why the committee has recommended excluding, well, if you look at the proposed changes on page 2, at 3A, excuse me, 3B, big B, any common elements of a multi-unit residential building that would otherwise qualify as a residential dwelling unit essentially cuts out all common areas, which that's where the envelope is. It's a common area. And then you look at as to what it does include, the exception in 3AB, I don't really even understand. A condominium unit within a multi-unit residential building consisting of four units or less that is not part of a multi-structure complex of buildings, all you've really done is include little teeny duplex and fourplex condominium projects, and you've excluded everything else that the consumer lives in. Our residents are more and more buying planned community and condominium product because that's all they can afford, because that's all that's being built. Our land use laws have limited the available land to the point that single-family dwellings are becoming more and more difficult for anybody to find. We simply do not feel that it's fair to discriminate against such a large portion of Oregon's consumers of residential real property. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you can make your short statements very short, we're nearing the end of our time slot. Thank you.
Again, my name is Dean Aldridge. I generally support this. I think the intent behind it is good. I think you're going to have a lot of trouble trying to figure out a way to administer it and to get it down statute-wise and be fair to all parties involved. I think there is a need for something like this, so I'd propose have some further work on it. I mean, one other option is to increase the bonding requirements for contractors. You're probably going to get more heat trying to do that than going this route, but that may be the better solution.
Thank you for your comments. I appreciate them. I don't think we have any questions for you right now.
What's the score? Knocks her out by 3. But that's not why I left. I went to testify on another bill. I didn't go to...
Thank you, Representative Bonamici, an alumni of Oregon. True green.
Isn't that it?
Next up, I'm sorry, Sean Miller of Scottsbury. And again, if you can identify yourself for the record and tell us why you like the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and CNA Surety, and here today in opposition to House Bill 2658, and I can say at the last work group meeting there was a lot of opposition to the bill. Again, the three components that I think I mentioned at the last hearing, the bill does have a $20,000 cap still on the bill. There is another bill, CCB bill, that does raise the bond from $15,000 to $20,000. I think will go a long way in capturing a lot of that, a lot of the problem. Section 5 of the bill still does assess contractors, so contractors in this particular proposal, the good contractors would be subsidizing the very few contractors that would have a problem. And then finally, on Section 6 of the bill, on the civil penalty money, taking that money and dedicating that money from the general fund to this particular fund, I think I would probably agree with the last panel that if you were, and this was part of the discussion in the Claims Task Force, if you were to include condos and a lot of those other items in this kind of a proposal, you would have to substantially fund a lot higher, and I think the general fund obligation would be a pretty big hit, and obviously Representative Galizio, being on that Ways and Means Committee, would have to make that decision. And so I think it's just a difficult bill to administer, and we feel there's better proposals. And like the last proposal, dealing with the building envelope, I think, again, building a package around that, such as the increase in the bond and some of the other items that have been discussed, will make a good package. We just don't feel that, this is necessary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Berry.
Good afternoon. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I think what we have here is a real good idea gone bad. And I may be the only person who ever thought it was a good idea, but then it was my idea. So that's probably why. The original thought behind this was just to take the civil penalty money and send it back to consumers injured during the CCB process. That was it. And the minute, and I'll refer to the section, but the minute you get into the Section 3 portions where you're adding arbitration awards and potential final judgments, you're really creating a scenario where unless you tap into the good contractor to pay for the bad, you've got no money to send back to these large arbitration awards or judgments. There's just nothing there. You might be handing out $10 bills at the end of the day instead of giving somebody $20,000 back. So, again, it was a real simple idea that got expanded, and I think with that expansion, it lost any merit. So that's all I've got.
Thank you. We've got time for a question if anybody has one. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for showing up on this beautiful Friday afternoon. Really appreciate everybody's testimony today. And with that, I'm going to close House Bill 2658 and also adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Have a good weekend.
Good job.
That is so funny. Mark, here. Excuse me.